philosophy. You know, I don't have a dictionary handy, but philosophy. I can't speculate on it. It sounds like a Greek word. Philosophy. I mean, basically, it is the discussion or the interaction between people regarding the characteristics and qualities of something in terms of reality. Now, reality is described in the Bhagavad Gita, nasato vidite bhavo na bhavo vidite sataha. That which will continue to exist perpetually, that is knowledge. And that which is temporary, that is not considered to be knowledge. So, philosophy is discussion, or not necessarily discussion, the presentation of knowledge. Anyway, I'm sure there's a better explanation than that.
Basically, these so-called sadhus, you know, who don't state the facts as it is and who manipulate the facts, don't go by the paramparas, are still able to attract people by the lakhs and millions wherever they go. Whereas, you know, ISKCON being such a big, large organization, it's not been able to attract so many people in spite of, you know, stating the facts as it is.
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest organizations, the biggest spiritual leaders in India consider that there are two groups who are actually the only hope for Hinduism. Because nobody else is really doing anything except for holding kathas and, you know, doing a big show. So ISKCON is one of those organizations. And they remark that Prabhupada is attracting people from all over the world. He was not per se a very charismatic teacher. He was charismatic to those who knew him and those who loved the truth. He was very charismatic. But to the general populace, he was not one of those, you know, from the mountains to the sea, and, you know. There's one fellow who used to tell stories. You know, he would tell. He was supposed to give a philosophy discussion on Gita Yajna. And, you know, he would just tell all kinds of stories, and often very complicated and detailed, but, you know, people got caught up in the network of the story. And afterwards, people would come out from the lecture and say, oh, he's so learned, so knowledgeable. And you ask him, what did he say? I don't know, he's too deep. I couldn't quite pick it up. That's one point, that ISKCON, it's true, we haven't got a lot of charismatic speakers. Who knows, maybe someday when some of our devotees are a little older. We do speak to groups of, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 people, but there's not the same attraction. Another point is that a lot of these speakers give the people what they want. They want to hear from Gopi Gita, or they want more entertainment than somebody just telling them you have to follow the four regulative principles, or somebody telling them you have to surrender. There are very few people who actually have the courage to tell people what is the right medicine. People who give bitter medicine are often least appreciated. A lot of people nowadays shy away from going to Ayurvedic doctors because they give bitter medicine. Whereas I go to my drugstore and I can get some candy-coated, you know, thing that's supposed to be medicine that's probably just a placebo with sugar on it. And, you know, but Ayurvedic medicine is effective even though it's bitter. Then the other thing is that Srila Prabhupada, he was definitely, his few words were more potent and would attract and bring out a far deeper level of surrender than so many so-called pretentious kathankars. Prabhupada, as I said, he attracted thousands and thousands of people from all backgrounds, all over the world. If he had stayed longer, and this is again conjecture, but I'm sure that if Prabhupada had stayed longer and had traveled to the temples that his disciples built, he would have attracted huge following. But then, you know, we're telling people, give up illicit sex, give up intoxication, give up meat eating, give up gambling. We say that you cannot chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra effectively unless you follow some basic principles. Now, if you don't follow principles, you should still start chanting. But when you actually become a little purified and make real progress, you will follow the regulative principles. Now, people don't want to hear that. In Bombay, they don't want to hear that. They're too busy having fun. So they think. Yes?
I just want to know, this, I believe this is from the second chapter. Second chapter, Buddha, that is, Sankhya Yoga, what does the Sankhya mean?
Sankhya Yoga is the analytical study of the material world. Now, there's two propounders of Sankhya. There is one who is an atheist and one who is an incarnation of Krishna and is preaching bhakti or devotion. So there are different ideas about Sankhya, but basically the analytical study of the material world should culminate in devotional service, bhakti yoga. Bahunam janmanam ante jnanavan. After many, many lifetimes of acquiring knowledge, when one does become learned, jnanavan, vasudeva sarvam iti samahatma suddurlabha. Although it's rare to find such a person, but his conclusion will be that there's nothing more than Vasudev, the son of Vasudev, in other words, Sri Krishna. The goal of Sankhya is to know Krishna. In other words, Sankhya, which is not connected with bhakti, is not yoga. Sankhya yoga means to link with God. Wherever that word yoga comes, it means to connect with the Supreme. So just to understand the material elements has no real value. God is unlimited, and you actually can't know the limits, his limits. He's inconceivable. Achintya Shakti. Is that okay? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Like the other day I met one person, like he was telling me, like we were discussing about kind of food we eat.
Yeah.
We should be a vegetarian, that too we should offer it to Krishna and Prasadam.
Yeah.
And he was telling me if we all people, if they just stop eating non-veg,
yeah,
and they switch on to vegetarian,
yeah,
the entire population will just go hungry because there won't be food left to eat.
Totally. So totally. Totally. Ignorant and bogus. For to fatten animals, the amount of land that it takes to fatten animals, to feed, say, one person, with that same amount of land, you could feed 20 people. I didn't, you know, I mean, you get the idea.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest causes of environmental disaster is this unlimited slaughter of animals so that we can have McDonald's. Because all of the land used to raise cattle, all the trees that are chopped down to grow grass and grains to feed those animals, and then all the affluence created by the slaughter of animals, the wastage, the sewage, etc., all the water that's used, all of those resources could be used to grow so much. That's the first thing. In one book called Diet for a Small Planet, a very famous lady, I forget her name just now, but she wrote a very famous book, Diet for a Small Planet. And she explained meat as being like a Rolls Royce for a wealthy man. It's a luxury that starves so many other people. It creates such an imbalance in the ecosystem in the world, the natural distribution of foodstuffs, etc. And there's so many of that. Whole plethora of very clear arguments against that idea. Totally ludicrous. Not at all supported by any facts. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you know how to speak to him now? Okay. I can give you some. You go on the internet. Just go. You have access to the internet? Okay. So go to the World Vegetarian Society and see the facts on meat diet versus vegetarian diet, and they'll give you pages and pages and pages of statistics. And then just shove it in his, not shove it in his face, but you know, give it to him with a piece of prasadam. Any other questions? Yes?
Well, in spite of knowing that how rascal the senses are, and in spite of knowing that we should control and contain the senses, why is it that we are generally getting carried away by the senses?
Because that is a perverted reflection of love of Krishna. Desire, our original desire was to love Krishna. But when we come into the material world, up becomes down and down becomes up. Urdhva Mula Adashaka, like a banyan tree with the branches down and the roots up. So our desires have become perverted, and we have to transform them. We don't stop desire, but we just transform them. We replace desire for McDonald's hamburger with the desire for Krishna's a veggie burger offered to Krishna. See? Same, getting the same thing, but it's prasadam. In the rest, we actually had a restaurant in Australia called McKrishna's. We got sued by McDonald's and had to give it up. But it was a very successful restaurant. People loved it. We were serving the same stuff, the same routine, milkshakes, fries, veggie burgers. And anyway. Transform your desires. Yes, Martin? Krishna is known as the?
Most perfect in renunciation.
Oh, most perfect in renunciation. That's an interesting question. Well, Krishna, of course, there are many reasons, but one very common reason given is that Krishna was dancing with the most beautiful women in the universe, and the most expert at satisfying, and every quality they had, best. And he was in the midst of, you know, 16,108 women who were just focusing on him, who wanted to embrace him and satisfy him, but he detected a little pride in their hearts. So he just walked away. He renounced the whole thing. It's said that a sweet maker is not attracted to sweets. Sometimes you find someone who's, you know, I knew one man, his name was Sadat Jivat Lal Chandu Halwai. Yeah. He's dead now, but he was a very close friend. So when we would go to his office for preaching, he would always, probably one of the reasons why we stayed in India, he would always bring out trays of all his best sweets for whichever devotees were in his office. But he never took sweets himself. So, of course he could have, I'm sure he enjoyed sweets, but he just wasn't lusty over them because he was the creator of them. And Krishna is the creator of everything, and he actually engages in amorous pastimes with the gopis, he actually engages in amorous pastimes with the devotees to serve them, because they have that desire to reciprocate with him. But finally, Krishna is not attached at any stage. He's the origin. Naranarayan Rishi, who is an incarnation of Krishna at the beginning of creation, he took that incarnation to perform extreme tapasya for the benefit of all conditioned souls. And he is even still performing such tapasya in the Himalayas, it's said. So, the demigods who are insecure sometimes in their position, they're always, anybody who is surrounded by material opulence has a tendency to worry about people usurping their opulence, like in Jewel Beach. All these big bungalows, what do they all have? A big fence around them. You know, it's not like they're open. And they always usually have, or they usually have a dog, and they always have lots of chokidars. Because they're worried that somebody will come and take away their opulence. They have so much opulence, but they're worried about strikes in the factory, they're worried about, they have so many anxieties. But Naranarayan Rishi, the demigods, they become insecure also. So they were thinking that this Naranarayan Rishi was performing tapasya and he would become powerful and usurp their position. So they sent some apsaras to try to seduce him, to try to break his tapasya. But then from his body so many beautiful damsels began to emanate. In other words, the sweet maker is not attracted by offering him the latest rasgulla. So, Krishna is the source or origin of everything. He does enjoy unlimitedly with his devotees, but he enjoys their loving feelings. And if they reciprocate with him in a negative way, then he hides from them. He's totally unattached. He has nothing to do with this material world. It is going on completely by his agents, separately. He is adhoksaja. He is above it all. He is simply engaged in rasa, transcendental pastimes. Does that answer your question? Or? No? One of the?
He's telling one of the opulences that is considered.
It's one of the six opulences of Krishna. Renunciation.
Yeah.
I know. Why is renunciation one of the six opulences? Interesting point.
Because if one is renunciate, then people get attracted to
him. Oh, that's right. That's the right answer, actually. The opulences attract. Krishna is known as all attractive. So there are six aspects about Krishna. Now, you know, I mean, this is kind of a corny example, but any, you know, probably Amitabh's best movies were the ones where he played very aloof and cool, you know. Or there used to be a famous movie actor in the West called Clint Eastwood. Anybody heard of Clint Eastwood? Okay. He's very famous. So his signature was that he was just totally aloof or detached, and that made him attractive. Someone who has it all but gives the impression that, or actually even in a loving relationship, there's a little psychology in here, but a woman is generally not so attracted by someone who's totally a slave to her. She's more attracted by someone who gives the impression that he could leave her at any moment. Or is a little detached. Shouldn't be passing these secrets out, but... it's a fact that renunciation is an attractive quality. And that's a good point, thank you. Therefore, it's an opulence of Krishna. Yeah. Yes. You realize that all of you are exhibiting renunciation from prasadam because by continuing these questions. Okay, go ahead.
Now, this jnana and bhakti, ultimately, they may start on different platforms. But ultimately, they meet at one point, it is said. They meet at one point. And from that one point onwards to the final goal, that is one path only, it is said. Now...
Well, I would put it a little different way. I would say that jnana leads to bhakti. Bhakti is already ahead of jnana. Jnana, bhakti is the culmination of all jnana. Now, while cultivating bhakti, if one takes help from jnana, just like we are taking help from the knowledge in Bhagavad Gita, but on the other side, just by reading the sacred conversation, we're engaging in bhakti. And to give you an example of that, there was a Brahmin in South India who was ordered by his guru to read Bhagavad Gita every day. So he was determined to do that. But there was one interesting thing about that, was he was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. So he used to hold the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes upside down, and, you know, his friends... He was trying to read it, but he couldn't read. And his friends used to ridicule and despise him even. What a fool. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu happened to pass by that way, and he met that brahmana, and he asked him what he was doing, and he said that my Guru Maharaj has given me this instruction, and I'm trying to read Bhagavad Gita, but I'm illiterate. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu remarked, okay, you're illiterate, but why are you crying? And he said, well, every time I pick up this book, I think of Krishna and how merciful he was that on the Battle of Kurukshetra he served his pure devotee Arjuna and how he delivered this wonderful message for everyone, and my heart swells up with such emotion, and I can't hold back the tears. And Lord Chaitanya said, you are the real reader of Bhagavad Gita. You have understood Bhagavad Gita. So, jnana leads on to bhakti, and jnana devoid of any bhakti, again, is not only is it inferior, but it may not be called jnana yoga per se. Bhakti should overcoat everything, including karma, jnana, or yoga, the Ashtanga yoga. The essence, bhakti, should be there right from the beginning before it has value. Without bhakti, nothing has value, because the goal is bhakti. Otherwise, it's simply on the process, on the path to attaining bhakti. You haven't really achieved the fruit of yoga until you come to bhakti. Why? Because Krishna says so. And he's Yogeshwar. He's Yogi Raj. That's Shastra. I didn't invent it. It's not that bhakti's my favorite. In fact, most people in the West like to go for hatha, which is one branch of Ashtanga yoga, because it helps you to get a nice figure. It helps you to develop your health. You can have better sex life. You know, it's very much appreciated. But it's not. And even if you go and sit down with BKS Iyengar and have a private discussion with him, even he will tell you that actually the whole goal is bhakti. He told one of our devotees, he said, I admire Prabhupada so much. He was 80 years old just recently. Pune, they had his birthday. BKS Iyengar, you've heard of him? Light of Yoga. Most famous yogi on the planet probably today. So he's a Iyengar. I mean, he's a Ramanuja, Vaishnava, his family. But he said, I got caught up with my publishers and others. To market my ware, I could not preach bhakti. I had to preach kind of impersonal idea, because it's attractive. Everybody wants to think that you sit this way, push your nose this way, and in a few months you become God. It's so attractive. Tantra Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jaya.